working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
Welcome back on Fuckers. Gonna jump right in on this to set the table for this episode. So we all heard this one, right?
So my warning, if you will, to corporate America is to stay out of politics. It's not what you're designed for.
Well, unfuckers, it was bound to happen at some point. We got ourselves our very first two-parter. This fuckery is so thick and layered, it was simply too much to ingest in one sitting. So in this first part, we're delving even further into the tangled web of bullshit that exists in the relationship between corporate America and our beloved government. You can certainly pick up with this show if you're new to the program. And if you are, a hearty, how the fuck are ya? Regular listeners have had primers on what we're about to highlight in this two-parter with a few of our past episodes, in particular, Capitalism, The American Propaganda Machine, Ayn Rand Was a Dick, and America Inc., where we explored the evils of privatization. Hopefully by now, some very obvious themes have developed in your minds, which we'll build upon today. But like I said, this should be able to stand on its own if this is your very first unfucking. Remember to hang on to the end of the show for listener shoutouts in Book Love and Pod Love, where we highlight books and podcasts that we think unfuckers will dig. As always, you can keep up with us between episodes by joining our fast-growing community of subfuckers over at unftr.substack.com. Membership there will always be free. Now, today's rundown is pretty packed. We'll start by discussing the political and economic philosophy that has guided the nation for the past 50 years and created a scenario where corporations reign supreme and workers have been villainized. We'll talk about how wealth is accumulated and examine taxes from a few different angles, including how and why our corporations park money offshore. We'll take a break for another very special undercover report obtained by our embedded investigative team, this time inside the Senate Republican Caucus.
Which I once again have to disclaim, since this isn't real and you're just trying to get us sued.
On the other side of this Pulitzer-worthy undercover report...
No, satire.
We'll expose the false logic behind our corporate tax system as a whole and disabuse a few popular notions around innovation as it relates to taxes and regulation. We're going to shoot for a quick turnaround on part two, where we'll investigate how corporations have misused their ill-gotten gains to fuck over the American public and suggest a few ways we can right the ship.
Ooh, sounds like a real barn burner.
Oh, just roll the fucking theme song, asshole.
Just roll the fucking theme song, asshole.
This is the story of a political pundit who looked at the world around him and just said, fuck it. Gives the middle finger to authority and says, kiss my ass. But instead of a revolution, he started a podcast. It's just what the world needs.
He started a podcast.
Another basic white guy who
started a podcast.
But it's fun because he curses.
All through the podcast.
I'm fucking the
There are nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rims, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today.
This clip from the movie Network is remarkable not only for its enduring truthiness, but because it was delivered by Ned Beatty, who had a remarkable career considering his breakout film featured him taking it in the tushy in Deliverance. Man, that sticks with you. Anywho, in Beatty's speech, he lands on the phrase natural order, which carries more significance than one might imagine. This is the first of our building blocks from prior episodes and one that draws us closer to this show's nemesis. You know who I'm talking about. The natural order is the concept that Enlightenment philosophers were kicking around in the 18th century. Many of the greats that we alluded to in the mass incarceration and capitalism episodes built their ideas of efficiency and inequality around what should be considered the natural order in the world. Punishment in the carceral sphere, the flow of goods in the burgeoning global market, and the distribution of wealth, food, and welfare. Now, for many of these thinkers, the New World was the proving ground for new concepts that broke from the feudal political and economic systems that governed human life for centuries. The challenge was to create a pure and natural system that melded human tendencies to the natural world in a manner that would produce equality. As you can imagine, given our obsession with the man, we have an upcoming episode dedicated entirely to the Chicago School of Economics and its patron saint, Milton fucking Friedman. I'm bringing him into the conversation now because Friedman, along with other giants of the time like George Stigler and Gary Becker, gained prominence in economic and political circles by building on these Enlightenment theories and taking the concept of natural order to an extreme that harkened back to the physiocrats of yesteryear. We'll talk more about them as well another time. Here's where the intersectionality of our prior episodes really comes to bear and elucidates the power of today's corporate structure, which has been building over the past 50 years. So it was around the 1970s when a quiet revolution of sorts really began to take hold in corporate America. You've got the Chicago boys, like Stigler and Friedman, committing to the idea that government really has no place in business and trade and that taxes and regulations of almost any kind were artificial impediments to the so-called natural order. Recall in our capitalism and incarceration episodes how these men essentially cherry-picked certain ideas from Beccaria, Bentham, and Smith to formulate the concept that government can only serve purposes related to punishment, punishing criminals and punishing other countries in the defense of our interests, a bastardization of nearly every philosopher's ideals except Le Mercier. These ideas found their way into policy through the likes of Ayn Rand sycophants such as Alan Greenspan. The natural order of economic policy made perfect sense to objectivists who believed that man, using man specifically as Rand herself loathed feminism, should be free to do as he pleases, and that bureaucracy and collectivism were evil. And for the trifecta from our episode on privatization, we have the Powell Memo, which has come to represent the birth of corporate intervention into our political system. Put it all together, and you have the beginning of neoliberalism, the theory that has dominated the American political system for the better part of the past 50 years. Right. So the economists teamed up with the politicians, who teamed up with corporate America, to fight back against, well, to fight back against us.
A working class hero is something to be.
Max, aren't you reading a bit too much into this? These are just theories and policies. Our capitalist system produces jobs and innovation. Now, sure, some people are left behind, but it's better than living in the Soviet Union.
We know what the arguments sound like, and the fact that this shit is complicated and layered is precisely what they're banking on. You got a smartphone and internet access? Then shut the fuck up. At least you're not in Russia. The American experiment is a success, so suck it. Well, there's nothing like a pandemic to really show how fragile things are for the American people. It's exposed so much new information about the way our political system works and how corporations are fucking us in the collective bunghole. A pandemic or a financial crisis and housing collapse, that is. Rare events that expose the flaws in our system. A pandemic, financial crisis, and housing collapse, terroristact.com meltdown. Just rare events that fuck us in the ass and prevent tens of millions of people from ever escaping poverty. A pandemic, financial crisis, and housing collapse, terroristact.com meltdown, global recession, stock market crash, savings and loan crisis, oil crisis, and a different global recession. But that's it. Rare. Just so fucking rare. The reality is that the American system since the 1970s has come apart at the seams pretty often. Some catalyzing, triggering events show how fragile the whole thing is and tends to wipe people out in an instant.
Sure, but we recover from these things so quickly. It's not the Depression or, you know, like Russia.
Again, part of the narrative that corporations feed us is to make us collectively say, there but for the grace of God go I. At least we're not socialists, yada yada. Here's the thing. These events aren't natural at all. They're the furthest thing from the so-called natural order of things. And when they happen, what do? Who's really affected by periodic economic meltdowns? You know who. Unfuckers know the numbers by heart. All of the wealth gains over the past 50 years have gone to the very, very top. Real wages for 90% of the country haven't moved. Moving out of poverty is a statistical anomaly in this country, but anyone that does is put on a pedestal and displayed as the example of the American dream. It's the best public relations scheme of the past 100 years. When these so-called rare events that happen like clockwork every 10 years wipe out the wealth for a majority of households in America, we're not really living the American dream. In reality, everyone is pretty much stuck in their birth situation, and much of that is determined by race and geography. One of the ways we transfer wealth, not just in the U.S., but globally, is through inheritance.
As the executor of your great uncle's will, I hereby declare that the full inheritance of $300 million is yours. Congratulations.
A couple of key points here before we talk more about the mechanisms of wealth accumulation and the effect of taxes. The last great study commissioned by the Bureau of Labor Statistics revealed some interesting statistics. First off, over about a 20-year period, 21% of American households at a given point in time received a wealth transfer, and these accounted for 23% of their net worth. As you might imagine, the proportion of wealth transfer is double in white households to non-white households. And of the non-white households, these wealth transfers tended to make up a much larger share of net worth. Fairly obvious stuff, though how you spin it really matters. Back to that in a second. Let's talk about the 1% for a moment. Turns out for the top tiers of wealthy people, wealth transfer as a share of their net worth fell during the same period. The report then draws the conclusion, it is therefore reasonable to conclude that inheritances and other wealth transfers have become less important for the rich as a source of wealth accumulation over these years. So, unfuckers, this is where we have to read between the lines a bit. A good chunk of the country receives a transfer of wealth. Historically, this is how people lived up to the adage of doing better than your parents. Of course, that's only applied to people who actually had money to begin with. It also explains how property ownership, insurance payouts, and retirement funds have kept wealth among white Americans for so long. Mechanisms of privilege for generations. Proportionately, wealth transfer occurs twice as often in white households as non-white households, even today due to the historical significance of these facts. Now, at the top, the transfers aren't as meaningful as they used to be, but among non-whites, wealth transfers are far more meaningful as a percentage of net worth. And this is put forward as sort of a positive thing. But here's the translation. When people die, they leave money behind to their heirs. In absolute and proportional figures, white people have more money than non-white people and therefore are able to leave more behind. The wealthiest among us receive inheritances, but it doesn't mean as much as a percentage of net worth anymore. And what does that mean? If the top 1% is still getting money from dead parents and grandparents, but it doesn't mean as much to them as it used to, it means they're killing it in other places, considering they've taken 90% of the wealth gains since the 1970s. So let's find out where they're killing it and how.
A working class hero is something to be.
Now that we've gone through a quick primer on wealth accumulation, let's get to the real meat of the episode, which is to talk about corporate America and its role in widening the wealth gap among Americans. Let's start by identifying the boogeyman here, because corporate America is a little broad. There are four main types of corporations, and you might very well work for one of them. You've got C-corps, S-corps, limited liability corporations, and nonprofit. There are other entities like partnerships and sole proprietorships, and a growing movement towards something called benefit corporations, and in some states, low-profit companies that are designed for a social benefit but don't really qualify as a true charitable organization. The difference between corporate structures relates primarily to two things: personal liability and tax consequences. I'm just putting that out there to level set on how we're defining corporations in this episode. For our purposes, we're going to focus on the C corporation, which is what most public companies are. We'll drift a little bit on this in our conscious capitalism section in the next episode to talk about the growth of B corporations, low-profit entities, and co-ops, but the most dominant type of company in the United States deserving of our love and attention is the Class C corporation. You see, C-corps truly control what we would define as wealth in this country. For our purposes, consider every public company traded on the major exchanges C-corps, and that's where we'll focus our attention. One quick note related to the decline of alternative weeklies and local journalism. Even though we're examining the larger class of corporations, the fact is that small companies employ the vast majority of Americans, and there's precious little oversight on them now that local newsrooms have shuttered and consolidated. But that too for another day. So we're talking about the big guys. And there's a tendency to focus on the billionaire class, and it's fair to say that many of them have developed from controlling interests in these type of corporations. But billionaires are really a class of their own. We like to keep track of people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Bill Gates because of their preposterous net worth. But it's not like they actually have $1 trillion in gold just sitting in a vault like Scrooge McDuck.
Money should never stagnate, but like ocean currents, circulate.
Recall in the privatization episode how Milton Friedman popularized the false concept that corporations exist solely to maximize profits. Now, in truth, corporations exist to sell a good or service within the legal framework of trade. and the corporate structure exists to shield shareholders from liabilities and provide taxes to the governing entities that help facilitate the movement of said goods and services. That's it. Corporations aren't mythical creatures that exist for higher purposes, but we somehow treat them as such. When we talk about taxing the rich, I think we need to start shifting the conversation towards a more holistic approach. It's not about taxing the rich as individuals. That might seem like it's what it is because it makes the headlines and would be fun to take money away from Jeff Bezos, but it's really more about controlling the ecosystem of wealth creation more tightly to prevent the massive leakage that occurs to places that circumvent the socioeconomic system that the nation is built upon. Individual rates, capital gains, carried interest tax loopholes, offshore tax havens, estate taxes, they're all part of the equation. But it's the individual rate that gets all the shine from politicians and the media. This is partly because it's the easiest and most relatable thing to focus on. But it's the superstructure that matters the most. Think about the wealth that exists in the financial world. Remember when candidate Trump talked about closing the carried interest tax loophole? Then remember when President Trump didn't? This provision allows money managers to have their investment gains taxed as capital gains and not income, which is more than 15% less than it should be. This is fucking insanity and should be one of the easiest fixes possible because it'll force investors to steer clear of short-term schemes to pump up stock values and be more deliberate in their investment decisions. Now, we're going to take a quick break with our special investigative feature, and on the other side, we'll look at why and how corporations hide money from the public, how much we're really talking about, how corporate America successfully sells this behavior as completely normal and necessary, and we'll blow up widely held myths regarding the benefit of low corporate taxes.
A working class hero is something to be.
Unfucking the Republic once again gained exclusive insider access, this time to a secret meeting conducted by Senator Mitch McConnell, held deep below the Senate chambers in an undisclosed location. The identity of the undercover unfucker is classified to protect all parties involved.
Remember, satire, not real. Please don't sue us.
This explosive audio has never been heard before.
Yeah, because we just made it up, and you're doing all the voices.
Stop it!
Fine, here we go.
Let's bring this meeting to order. We have invited guests here today, so let's begin by introducing them.
Mr. William Shaw.
Señor William Shaw.
Representing the General Fruit Company.
Representando the General Fruit Company.
Messrs. Congol and Dan.
Señores Congol and Dan.
Of United Telephone and Telegraph Company.
De la United Telephone and Telegraph Company.
Mr. Petty.
Señor Petty.
Regional Vice President of the Pan American Mining Corporation.
Regional de la Pan American Mining Corporation.
Mr. Robert Allen of South American Sugar.
Señor Robert Allen de la South American Sugar.
And Mr. Michael Corleone of Nevada.
Y señor Michael Corleone de Nevada.
Representing our associates in tourism and leisure activities.
De placer.
As you know, we have a serious problem with corporate America. For decades, we have enjoyed the cooperation and support of...
Where are all the checks? Ted said there'd be checks.
Yeah, underage checks.
Gentlemen, this is for senators only. Your meeting is across the hall.
Shut up, ass munch. Ted Cruz said to meet him here.
Yes, he's friends with us. Yes, yes.
He gave us his password to RedTube.
Shut up, Nestor.
He's watching my dog while we was in Cancun. Stupid turtle brushes.
Well, it's not appropriate. You should be at the Anglo-Saxon meeting down the hall.
Anglo-Sexting. Sweet.
Now, as I was saying, we have enjoyed...
I bought new shoes for the meeting. Aren't they pretty?
Lindsay, please. You know what? We'll just start with our Treasury report from Senator Rubio.
Mr. McConnell, before we begin, I'd like
Now, Susan, you know the rules. No women actually speak in these chambers. You're just here for show.
But it's about Lindsay's shoes.
Aren't they fabulous?
Nevertheless, she persisted. Can we please table the issue of Senator Graham's shoes? Senator Rubio, proceed.
Dude, those chicks fucking shot at us.
It's Marjorie and Lauren's right to bear arms. It says so in the Bible.
That's the Constitution, Senator Inhofe, not the Bible, silly. By the way, do you like my shoes?
Gentlemen, please, escort Mr. Gates and his son out of the chamber. Thank you. Now, where was I? Oh, for the love of, what now?
Come on, guys. This isn't funny. I know you're in there.
Damn it. Who told Senator Romney about this meeting?
I did. Every man has a natural right to do what he pleases.
Damn it, Rand. I'm gonna make you caucus with the Democrats if you don't stop telling Romney about our meetings.
Tell him Joseph Smith buried gold tablets beneath the Lincoln Memorial or something.
My precious gold tablets I will take.
No, Senator Cruz, they're not real tablets. Good Lord.
No, but these gold sparkles in my shoes are the real deal.
This meeting is adjourned.
If you watch corporate business media, you'll hear euphemisms like money on the sidelines or dry powder to describe the amount of cash that companies are hoarding on their balance sheets. Let's dig into this a bit to understand the rationale behind this. First off, it's rare to hear any of these same pundits talk about how this money is often parked offshore. Once again, candidate Trump made a big deal about this, though he blamed the corporate tax structure in America and promised that he would take care of corporations by delivering them a, quote, tax holiday to repatriate these funds back into the United States. He actually delivered on this promise, which I suppose is one way to go about this. Indeed, Trump's tax cut and repatriation holiday brought home just north of $1 billion, which is like pissing in the ocean to warm it up. But it was a start. What I find fucking ludicrous is that we would offer an incentive of any kind to repatriate money that was held offshore through loopholes, albeit legal ones, that stole from the American people. Everything always has to be in favor of corporate America. Can you imagine Teddy Roosevelt pleading with corporations to bring back stolen money by offering them incentives? He would have marched into the boardrooms and fucking beaten the CEO to death. It begs the question as to why a corporation would hold money offshore anyway. You can't spend it. There's only so many fucking helicopters and jets you can buy when we're talking trillions, right? What's the fucking point? Like, if you're a wealthy individual, you can just buy shit in other countries, like wine, homes, diamonds, cars, boats, whatever. So that makes sense. But why would a public company work so hard to keep cash in a place that they can't put it to use? The answer? Share price. Cash on a balance sheet, no matter where you hold it, shows strength and contributes to the value of your company. That's where the real money is, building up shareholder value. Executives in the modern era have made an art of enriching themselves personally through value, not actual productivity. Since the turn of this century, there's been a huge trend towards paying executives through stock options for a couple of reasons. One is optics. Since the financial crisis in particular, it's considered poor form to literally pay people tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. It just looks bad. It's so much easier and trickier to pay them a rational salary and then give them enough options to buy a fucking island. Plus, when they exercise those options, as we talked about before, selling them is considered a capital gain and not income, so they're taxed less.
The fact that this motherfucker is not serving time in some federal penitentiary is a huge, hot, heaping pile of horse.
I love that we found the one clip of Samuel Jackson saying motherfucker with a bleep in it. Anyway, so the more cash you have on a balance sheet by storing it offshore and keeping it from being taxed, the more you can inflate the value of a company and increase the share price. The greater the share price, the greater the value of the executive stock options. The more your income consists of exercising these options, the less likely you are to be taxed at a normal rate. Win, win, win. David Carton, a lawyer who served under Obama, recently wrote a piece in Foreign Policy about the great tragedy of this phenomenon, especially during a pandemic. He estimates that there's somewhere in the neighborhood of, wait for it, $36 trillion in cash, gold, and securities, not including tangible assets such as real estate, art, and jewels. And for comparison, U.S. federal tax revenues are a little over $3 trillion a year. He goes on to quote the Tax Justice Network, which ranks the United States as the second most complicit country after the Cayman Islands in helping individuals to hide their assets. So $36 trillion is a global figure. When trying to determine the amount being sheltered by U.S. corporations, the network estimates that it's about 10% of our wealth, which could be in the neighborhood of $10 trillion. Harvard Business Review estimates that, quote, U.S. non-financial corporations are sitting on over $4 trillion in cash, according to the latest flow of funds estimates, up from $2.7 trillion a decade ago and just $1.6 trillion in 2000. So if we're to believe their methodology for non-financial firms, then the $10 trillion estimate in total might be pretty accurate for the U.S. We're hiding $10 trillion fucking dollars offshore.
Why make trillions when we could make billions?
I've linked the HBR article in the show notes because there are a number of other great revelations, but I'll leave you with this one. The article points out the absurdity behind lowering corporate taxes in the U.S. to 21% because most of the countries where our corporations are parking money are way below that threshold. So Trump's tax repatriation plan and theory that companies will be tripping over themselves to bring money back to the U.S. from offshore was just never the case. It was all window dressing and explains why only a billion of an estimated $10 trillion was repatriated. Unfuckers, we've been had again. Oh my God, what a con. It's really a thing of beauty, especially because corporate America has been so effective at blaming the working class. Think about it. Who's destroying American wealth according to what you hear, see, and read? Unions. The fight for minimum wage. Taxing the rich, which burdens the so-called job creators. $10 trillion in fucking cash parked offshore versus the fight for a living wage? The fact that so many of us, so many of our friends and our family members, just people that you know, have fallen for this line of bullshit is a testament to the massive coordination of messaging by corporate America to shift the blame from their thievery. Let's pause for a round of applause, unfuckers. Of course, it's not as easy as just raising taxes on corporations here in the United States. Corporations who, by the way, already received a windfall under Trump when he cut the effective corporate tax rate to 21%, just a hair above capital gains. It's a global world, right? It's why giants like Apple and Google are located here and traded on American exchanges, but domiciled in other countries. They'll do anything to avoid paying taxes to the country that founded them. And it's all perfectly legal. It's one of the reasons Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recently argued for a global minimum tax to prevent companies from sheltering cash in offshore havens. She wants to level the playing field across the world to take away the incentive to hide and prevent what she calls the race to the bottom. Now, apart from this being a good and fair idea, the real reason behind it is because Uncle Joe has made a host of promises like the infrastructure plan that he can't pay for. And Republicans, as we've covered before, will once again make deficits an issue, even though they don't really give a flying fuck about deficits. Of course, I'm not all that optimistic about Yellen's ability to get this done. I imagine that her call for a global corporate tax rate will be met with snickers from other countries that make a living on being havens for American money. And it's easier today to move the domicile of a country without sacrificing the exchange that it's traded on. It's more difficult for companies on the lower end of the public spectrum to pull off this kind of financial fuckery, but the big guys can afford to just keep fucking moving around the world with alacrity. Plus, Yellen's proposal will likely be met with a hearty "go fuck yourself" by other countries who are used to the U.S. inventing its own advantages. So now that it's no longer working for us, oh, you're just going to change the rules. Fuck you.
Working class hero is something to be.
Now let's dispense with the arguments you hear from pundits on the right about keeping taxes low. First, there's the argument that high corporate taxes will drive companies out of the United States. Well, according to the Tax Foundation, currently corporations in the U.S. pay federal income tax of 21% plus a range of state taxes that result in a combined average top tax rate of 25.8%. Do you know where that puts us? Smack dab in the fucking middle. And if you take the Caribbean and corrupt Eastern European countries out of the equation, we're on the lower end of the average. And to quote Robert Reich, the U.S. collects less corporate taxes as a percentage of economic output than any other industrialized country on the planet.
For Christmas, we are giving them a big, beautiful Christmas present in the form of a tremendous tax cut. It will be the biggest cut in the history of our country. It'll also be tax reform, and it'll create jobs.
One of the most overplayed tropes is the idea that taxes kill job creation, so let's get that bullshit out of the way. It's one of those fucking concepts that lingers and feels too hard to explain when somebody throws it in your face. So here you go. Over a 30-year period between 1950 and 1980, the average corporate tax rate was about 50%. Over this same period, unemployment ranged from a low of 2.5% in the 50s to a brief spike of 9% during the oil and inflation crisis, but the trend line over 30 years was about 5%. In other words, there's zero statistical correlation between corporate tax rates and employment, so let's just close the fucking door on this already. Here's one that we talked about before when we covered John Mackey's interview on conscious capitalism. the argument that corporations should barely be taxed because it frees them to reinvest in themselves, and a low-tax environment has led to American ingenuity and innovation. Sounds good. It's actually the fucking opposite. And that's a big, bold statement, unfuckers. If you tax corporations at a higher rate and cut off their ability to park money offshore, which we'll get to in a moment, it reduces a company's option to extract immediate value. So why would I say that? I would argue, actually, that we should leave personal income taxes much lower and increase them on corporations because it would encourage larger salaries.
Max, what are you fucking talking about?
Well, not only does this make income more trackable, but it puts more money back into programs like Medicare and Social Security. I'll go a step further and say that the way to sell this to the American people is to reduce the Social Security deduction for everybody, but lift the cap on it, meaning that you pay into it no matter how much you earn. Revisit our Reagan episode to review how Greenspan really fucked us on that one. And if you package all of this with a reversal in the carried interest loophole and punitive measures for hiding money offshore, you can strangle corporations into keeping their money here and paying their fair share. Force executives to go back to overpaying themselves with monster salaries and let them wrestle with the optics of that. All the while, we'll actually collect our fair share on the funds that the working class generates. You see, we need to force corporations to stop thinking in terms of building wealth through the markets and think about building it through people. And with respect to innovation, I'll go even further on that and tell you that there isn't a single fucking innovation corporate America can point to that wasn't created since the late 1970s.
What? Yet another bold unfucking statement.
Well, let me ask you this. Was innovation stifled in the post-war era when the internet was fucking invented along with every other defense technology? Innovation didn't happen because of reduced taxes. The greatest innovations were birthed at a time when the top marginal tax rates were 70%. And how can I make this case? Because of Moore's law of exponential growth. See, Moore's law is the observation that the number of transistors in a dense integrated circuit doubles about every 2 years. But you can apply this theory to nearly every so-called innovation corporate America takes credit for these days. We're living through a period of extraordinary innovation today because the seeds that were planted in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. There are no new innovations that didn't take root during this time. We've improved upon them, but we haven't created anything new.
How can you say that? Look at all the amazing technology we have today. Artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, electric vehicles, you name it.
You know when the first Journal of Artificial Intelligence was published? 1980, because it was already a maturing discipline by then. Facebook, Google, Amazon, they all rely on the Internet. They didn't invent the Internet, the fucking government did, in the 60s, no less. And the first supercomputers, they were invented then as well, all financed by the government and higher education.
Well, how about the Green Revolution?
Photovoltaic technology was invented in 1954.
Electric vehicles?
Go watch Who Killed the Electric Car. You name an innovation, and I'll point you right back to the period when the government subsidized it, corporate taxes were higher than 50%, and nobody had a fucking problem with any of it. Corporations don't innovate. People do.
The thing is, Bob, it's not that I'm lazy. It's that I just don't care.
Don't care?
It's a problem of motivation, all right? Now, if I work my ass off and Inditex ships a few extra units, I don't see another dime. So where's the motivation?
Fuck Milton Friedman. Offshoring is unpatriotic. Unfuckers rule. Here endeth the first part of the lesson.
If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Previously on Unfucking the Republic. In part one, we began by talking about the concept of natural order, an Enlightenment theory of how economic and political systems could work and how the Chicago School of Economics tweaked and bastardized these theories in the 60s and 70s to concoct a perverted view of socioeconomic policy that essentially said corporations should be free to do whatever the fuck they pleased. We went on to explain how they teamed up with politicians to make socialism and communist Russia the scapegoat for all things terrible in the world while they busied themselves with undoing the regulatory and tax framework in the United States that allowed for social mobility, innovation, and expansion to occur for more than just the top 1%. We explained how corporations worked, blew up Milton Friedman's myth that corporations are magical creatures that exist only to maximize shareholder value, and covered how wealth is transferred from generation to generation. How corporations pulled off a remarkable con job to sell the American people that it's actually somehow okay to hide money in offshore accounts, and did the math to show that they're actually holding somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 trillion offshore to avoid paying the piper back home. In the middle of all this nonsense, we played our exclusive audio, obtained from a secret Senate Republican meeting in a bunker deep below Congress.
Satire. Don't sue.
Well, we're excited to announce that our undercover agent remained incognito and made her way into a secret Senate Democrat meeting.
More satire. More not suing us.
Anywho, part one concluded with the assertion that we should be paying less attention to individual tax rates and more to corporations, which is the nightmare scenario and conversation the moneyed class really doesn't want us to be having. There, you're all caught up. Okay, kids. It's time. It's time to hear from the man himself. I'll explain the context on the other side of this clip.
Since the attack on the Corvair, government has been spending more and more money in the name of protecting the consumer.
This is hardly what the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, whose monument this is, had in mind when he defined a wise and frugal government as one which restrains men from injuring each other and leaves them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement. Ever since the Corvair affair, the U.S. government has increasingly been muscling in between buyer and seller in the marketplaces of America. By Thomas Jefferson's standards, what we have today is not a wise and frugal government, but a spendthrift and snooping government.
That's him, unfuckers. Uncle Milton himself. Just an aw shucks, free market loving Jeffersonian trying to protect the regular American from things like seatbelts and airbags. This is a pivotal moment in U.S. history and in our story today. What he's responding to here is Ralph Nader's activism on behalf of the consumer. And for those who aren't really familiar with Nader, it's difficult to explain the impact he had on American society in the 1970s. Nader is the standard bearer of consumer advocacy, and his brand of advocacy goes way beyond products and safety. The nadir of Nader, see what I did there, was a controversy surrounding GM's Corvair model, which was the subject of Nader's first chapter in his landmark book, Unsafe at Any Speed. In it, he argued that the rear axle suspension made the Corvair unsafe the faster one traveled. I've linked an article from Road and Track that upholds this theory, though at the time, Nader was demonized by a GM smear campaign that included trying to trap him with sex workers and illegally tapping his phone. Nader would become the poster boy for consumer protection and the most hated man in corporate America for decades as a result of this book and subsequent activism, which even included a run for President of the United States. His efforts didn't go unnoticed in Chi-Town, where Milton Friedman and his merry band of shit-sniffers held Nader up as the pinnacle of government intervention and anti-capitalism. Remember when we covered the Powell memo? Powell as well was reacting to the rise of consumer advocates like Nader and encouraged corporate America to get into political lobbying to start fighting fire with fire.
Discover how in 1979, Biff successfully lobbied to legalize gambling and turned Hill Valley's dilapidated courthouse into a beautiful casino hotel.
So notice what Friedman does in this clip in a really folksy way. First off, just prior to him speaking, there's footage of a driver crushing a racetrack in a Corvair, as if to prove the point that, hey, if a professional race car driver in a helmet on an empty track can drive this thing safely, what's your fucking problem? Milton then invokes the great Thomas Jefferson, saying he would be disappointed in all this hoo-ha over protecting people. We should just be able to do whatever the fuck we want. At some point, we'll talk about the libertarian strain of the Chicago School philosophy and how they amplified certain aspects of Jefferson's themes. Side note, I heard you loud and clear on the need for a libertarian episode, Scott C. So, forget the fact that Jefferson was a slave owner, didn't even think that we needed a national fucking bank, and went back on his own words so many times as president, it's hard to even keep track. What Friedman and others have mastered is the art of cherry-picking the founding fucker mindset and inserting it into modern-day situations as if any of these slave-owning, syphilis-carrying, wife-cheating, but really smart cock-knockers would have an opinion on fucking airbags and cars. But Nader was just another advocate in a long line of citizens who called out corporate injustice. Unfortunately, he's really one of the last great examples because of corporate America's coordinated attack against regulations. Up to this point, some of the most notable reforms in our nation's history came from journalists and citizens like Nader, who put a human face on the everyday tragedies of the capitalist system. From Jacob Riis's photos of tenements leading to housing reform, Upton Sinclair's descriptions of slaughterhouses leading to food safety reform, and, as we promoted recently, Steinbeck's portrayal of the forgotten farmers of the Dust Bowl in The Grapes of Wrath that sparked congressional discussions on wage reform. But by the 1970s, corporate America had just about had it with all of these pesky do-gooders poking around in their business, and indeed, they fought back.
A working-class hero is something to be.
Here's where we can draw on some prior themes on fuckers. Think back to our American Propaganda episode where we spoke about the rise of corporate-backed think tanks in the United States and how the media began consuming their literature as fact-based evidence because it was supposedly independent.
That's a terrific story. We have newspaper people on the payroll, don't we, Tom? They might like a story like that.
Over the next couple of decades, the number of mostly conservative think tanks doubled and then doubled again. All backed by big corporate dollars, and they were pumping out piece after piece about the wonders of free market ideology and the evils of regulation. At the same time, they were pouring an enormous amount of resources into doubling down on the need for tax cuts in order to preserve capital for global competitiveness and innovation, which we discussed in part one. Many of the economic assumptions in these materials were being pumped out by none other than the Chicago School. The underlying theory was that market efficiency was far more effective in protecting the consumer than government regulation could ever be. In theory, that makes a lot of sense, right? In theory, a company that hurts, maims, kills, and sickens its customers wouldn't be in business for very long, right? The intersection of tax cuts, deregulation, and free market propaganda is important. The tax cuts had the effect of turning big corporations into absolute juggernauts that could afford to paper over their misdeeds with fines, advertising, and PR. First of all, we're still dealing with the fallout of the environmental calamities created by large industries. Remember that things were so bad that even the Nixon administration, which was considered pretty conservative at the time, helped pass legislation to reform the environmental practices of industry in the United States. Remember when conserve was actually part of the word conservative? Dig this clip.
Each of us all across this great land has a stake in maintaining and improving environmental quality, clean air and clean water, the wise use of our land, the protection of wildlife and natural beauty, parks for all to enjoy. These are part of the birthright of every American.
So for a while, it looked like we were actually making some progress. Investigative journalism was arguably at its peak in the late 60s and 70s. Environmental reforms were being passed in a bipartisan manner because we were listening to scientists. What a fucking concept! And the planet and the worker were taking center stage against the backdrop of the civil rights and gender equity movements. So we had progress like, hey, you can't dump tungsten into the waterways. Lead pipes are really bad for drinking water. Hydrochlorofluorocarbons are actually contributing to global warming. Solar power looks like a good idea, so we should incentivize it, etc. Then, as you recall in the Reagan episode, the double whammy of the oil shock and inflation spike caused the first real disruption to our pocketbooks and really fucked the economy in the late 70s. In a matter of just a few short years, there was a team locked and loaded with a shiny playbook that promised to right the ship and restore pride in America. America, yeah. Needless to say, the other team, the good guys, they really weren't prepared at all. Perhaps the most surprising aspect of this entire period is just how organized the opposition was and how prepared they were to undo all of the social, environmental, and consumer protection movements that had recently taken root. The swiftness and totality of it all is blinding. They hit it all, and the United States went on a deregulatory frenzy the likes of which we had never seen before. Between 1980 and 2000, environmental regulations were shattered. The mass incarceration movement went into overdrive. Worker protections and unions were crushed, corporate taxes were slashed, and the coup de grace at the close of the century was the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which let loose a torrent of financial fuckery that haunts us to this day. I don't mean to be patronizing here by condensing a well-worn story most unfuckers are aware of, but I felt it was worth recapping because deregulation and tax cuts really did go hand in hand to blow up the capitalist Chicago School natural order neoliberal philosophy, which is that markets self-regulate better than government. They don't. At a certain size, you don't have to worry about breaking the rules as long as you can afford to pay the penalty. So let's take a breath and take a break and catch up with our undercover investigative team. On the flip side, we'll demonstrate just how easy it's been for corporations to break the rules at our expense and pay the price with stolen funds.
Our embedded undercover agent remained in the halls of Congress after surreptitiously recording a secret Republican Senate meeting last week. Undetected, she moved through an underground tunnel to gain access to Senate Democrats. The audio you're about to hear is from a covert meeting to discuss President Biden's infrastructure plan.
Unfuckers, you know the deal with these. I can't control them.
This extremely sensitive audio is exclusive to Unfucking the Republic.
Yeah, because no one else would ever run this. All right, here we go.
Would someone mind telling me where Chuck is? We were supposed to begin an hour ago.
But then they switched from the swing line to the Boston stapler, but I kept my swing line stapler because it didn't bind up as much, and I kept the staples for the swing line stapler.
Senator Kane, you can keep your damn stapler. Where is Chuck?
No more questions at this time. I'll cover it at my next press conference.
Sorry I'm late. What did I miss?
We were talking about my resolution to rename the George Washington Bridge to the Rosario Dawson Bridge.
Ugh, no we weren't, Senator Booker.
I think it's a fabulous idea.
Senator Graham, get out of here.
Touchy, touchy.
We need to discuss President Biden's infrastructure plan.
President
Joe, what are you doing here?
Just got off the 905 with my fellow strap hangers. Was telling them that old yarn about Corn Pop, the gangbanger. Come on, man.
Mr. President, you shouldn't be here.
Kamala's here?
There you are. He's a wily one, that Joe Biden. Come on, Joe. Soup's on.
Great. Is Strom coming to lunch?
You bet. And Ted Kennedy, too.
Hot damn. Come on, man.
Can we please... Chuck, where are you going?
It's my 7-past-the-hour press conference. Have Senator Feinstein cover for me.
Good to have you back, you horror-hungry human.
get a load of that lady. Dude, is she even alive?
Nestorphilia.
gross.
Mr. Gates, get out of here. This is a Democrats-only meeting.
Then what are you doing here, Grandpa? You're not even a Democrat.
Believe me, and let me be absolutely clear about this. Sometimes I have no idea. Is there anyone here that can talk about this goddamn infrastructure bill?
Black and white and brown and Asian and short and tall and gay and straight.
Hey, he got to name a bridge after his daddy. Why can't I name one after Rosario Dawson, the actor and national treasure whom I happen to be engaged to, if y'all didn't know? That's infrastructure.
Ugh. First off, Governor Cuomo doesn't belong here. Second, Senator Booker, renaming a bridge isn't the same as fixing one. Third, somebody closed Diane's crypt. It's starting to smell in here. This bullshit is adjourned.
There's an amazing site called goodjobsfirst.org that is truly doing the Lord's work by tracking corporate violations. The user experience is a little challenging, but it's a treasure trove of data that will make you either angry or a little excited if you're a fellow masochist. I'm just going to give you a couple of highlights to drive home the point that most corporations don't give a fuck about breaking rules that endanger public health because our tax structure has made them so fucking wealthy, it's easier to pay the fines than follow the rules. Since 2000, the Environmental Protection Agency, which has seen its budget and resources continually slashed, especially during the Trump years, levied $61,489 million in fines for more than 17,000 corporate violations. $61 billion, 17,000 violations. The EPA is here to protect us. Our water, our air, land, natural resources of all kinds. And even with a dwindling budget and staff, they managed to write 17,000 violations. At the top of the list is none other than Koch Industries, parent company owned by Chucklehead brothers Charles and David Koch. One of them is dead, doesn't matter which, who are arguably the biggest fucking turds corporate America has ever squeezed out.
Do not go in there. Woo!
Koch Industries, one of the largest anti-regulation lobbying champions in America, have racked up almost $1 billion in fines spread over more than 400 violations. You see, they just don't care. It's cheaper to pay than to play. We're already fast approaching a time, however, when this kind of shit will look like child's play compared to the likes of Amazon. This, my dear unfuckers, is a whole other class of criminal. The difference is companies like Koch Industries are the guy behind the guy. Half of the time, you don't even know who they are, what they own, or what they're polluting. Amazon, on the other hand, owns the consumer supply chain hard stop. We pay them for media, for next day delivery. Their boxes have happy little smiley faces that release endorphins in your brain when you get a brown box on your doorstep. More than a third of the world's websites exist on Amazon web servers. And now they're in the food business. We're addicted to Amazon and they fucking know it. The pandemic was particularly good to the giant online retailer, with 2020 revenue closing near $400 billion and profits increasing from $11.5 billion in 2019 to $21 billion in 2020. Now, compared to peers like Google and Microsoft, their bottom line numbers are actually low, but they're gaining ground quickly. Walmart is still a larger company, but Amazon blows their profit margin away. Now, we know by share price that Amazon is very valuable. But in real top line and bottom line dollars, at this trajectory, it's conceivable they could gross $1 trillion within the decade, and perhaps sooner. And yet, we've given Amazon subsidies in the US in various forms totaling $2.9 billion, and they're one of the biggest tax cheats as well. Over the last 3 years, Amazon has paid an effective tax rate of 4.3%. Do you remember when the subject of our second unfucking quickie, AOC, was raked over the coals for killing the Amazon warehouse deal in her district?
Freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is taking enormous criticism from some in her own party and her own state for her role in Amazon's decision to cancel plans for a huge investment in New York.
Let's look at this more closely. Amazon looks to locate their hubs near wealthy areas so that they can service their prime customers that can afford to pay prime fees. But they don't drop a fulfillment center right in the middle of a swanky neighborhood. They go to the closest nearby low-income community with higher Black and Latinx populations. Then they have the gall to ask for tax breaks and subsidies for blessing these areas with new jobs that have higher injuries and pay scale no greater than what currently exists, especially in an area like fucking New York. What her district needed was not another marginal paying warehouse facility that was subsidized to come there. It needs affordable housing. Furthermore, do you know who you're robbing when you give tax breaks to a company that has the means to basically pay anything in taxes? You rob the local school district and the municipality of the revenue that they sorely need, revenue that they otherwise would have received from buildings that were on the property tax rolls. And so by having fleets of cars in and out of the areas, workers for all shifts and delivery vehicles, you also create congestion and pollution and wear and tear on the area, but no taxes to offset it. So net-net, these deals are extremely corrosive. But AOC was really taken to task for being a job killer. But dig this. Prior to the pandemic, the jobless rate in Queens was less than 3%, just like the rest of the country. So no, her district does not need more fucking warehouse jobs. It needs affordable housing. People outside of her district were killing her over this. But maybe she won the primary with 74% of the Democratic vote and the general with 71% of the vote because she actually understands what the fuck her district needs. What I appreciate about the GOP is that they're not hiding their intentions. Theirs is less ideology and more theology. There is a real hardened belief that corporations are superior to all things political and social, and that we need to protect them with the utmost fervor. Democrats, on the other hand, are far more disingenuous when it comes to playing this game. But they have their hands out just as much as the Republicans do. They just talk out of both sides of their mouths. Just look at Schumer's donations if you need confirmation of just how in the fucking tank Democratic leadership is with big business. If you're following David Sirota's Substack journey, The Daily Poster, and if you're not, you really need to, then you've likely seen him pick apart corporate Dems like Manchin and even shill progressives like Sinema. One of the craziest things on the table right now is the proposed increase for corporate taxes as part of Biden's infrastructure agenda. But all they're pressing for is to increase corporate taxes to 28%. That's only halfway to where it was when Trump cut it. It's preposterous, and hopefully we did a good enough job in the first part to illustrate why they can afford to pay more and how everyone actually benefits when they do that. Even the top tier of income earners, not the billionaire class, they're a different animal. The top income earners would be insulated from harm under this scenario because it would incentivize corporations to pay people more across the board. Of course, this can't happen in a silo. In order to make this effective, you would have to simultaneously tighten the noose around corporate America's wallet to prevent them from parking money offshore or using loopholes to evade taxes. The maddening part of this is actually how surprisingly easy it would be if the appetite existed to do so in Congress. Here are a few suggestions from our friends at Good Jobs First to get us started. Subject accountants, lawyers, and bankers to criminal prosecution for aiding and abetting tax evasion. Deny offshore financial centers, commonly referred to as OFCs or shadow banks, the ability to clear dollar-denominated transactions in New York, which would essentially deny them access to the international banking system. Deny aid to all countries that house OFCs. And here's an obvious one. Just pass a law to make tax structures designed to evade taxes illegal and make it mandatory jail time for both the convicted tax cheat and their enablers. That would shut all of this shit down. And it could all be done with legislation, and a lot of this could just be done by executive order. There are dozens of other arcane suggestions that would effectively shut down this practice, as we discussed in part one, and the vast majority of these companies would be unable to move their corporate domicile and could even risk their listing on U.S. exchanges. The comprehensive takeaway, my dear unfuckers, is that corporations have had it their way entirely since 1980. Deregulation has gone their way. Taxes have gone their way. They're hiding $10 trillion fucking dollars, our money, offshore to pump up the value of their shares by compounding cash gains and inflating their balance sheets. Compensation packages have been so absurdly enlarged that the fastest growing segment of the U.S. population are new millionaires, while the middle class shrinks and the poor continue to be left behind. As we heard in our propaganda episode, they're even writing state and federal laws directly. Any illusion of a firewall between corporate America and Washington, D.C. has evaporated because no one really cares. Every day, these companies carry out the heist of a lifetime, and no one bats an eyelash. So why do we let them? Why do we cower to their might and fawn all over the wealthy executive? I'll leave that final word to the great acerbic columnist and satirist of yesteryear, H.L. Mencken. I know he was problematic at times on some stuff, but boy, some of his shit really holds up. Here's Mencken.
Perhaps the most valuable of all human possessions, next to an aloof and sniffish air, is the reputation of being well-to-do. Nothing else so neatly eases one's way through life. There is in 90% of all men, and in 99% of all Marxists, who value money far beyond its worth, and are always thinking of it and itching for it, an irresistible impulse to crook the knee to wealth, to defer to the power that it carries with it, to see all sorts of superiorities in the man who has it or is said to have it. True enough, envy goes with the craven neck, but it is envy somehow purged of menace. The inferior man, at bottom, is afraid to do evil to the man with money. He's even afraid to think evil of him. That is, in any patent and offensive way. What stays his natural hatred of a superior, I dare say, is the snaking hope that he may get some of the money by being polite, that it will pay him better to caress than to strike.
We have related episodes coming up, including one on conscious capitalism and a really deep dive into the Chicago School. Our next one is a departure, but it's an important one. It's all I can say for now. In the meantime, unfuckers, conscious capitalism is an oxymoron. Amazon is Skynet. #FMF. Here endeth the lesson.